for posterity's sake. So this, I'm Wendy Gettelberg. I'm the executive director at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and of our interview with Alan Blinder, and it is the 17th of September. So, you know, first I should say thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. This is very helpful, and we're really grateful for your time.
You're most welcome.
Thank you. So, I guess just to jump right in, I know that having read some of the stuff that you've written lately, you have some views on why we had a financial crisis. I think, you know, beginning with derivatives and going through mismanagement of TARP. If you just wanted to summarize those for us quickly, that would be fantastic.
Well, that's not easy to summarize quickly. But I'll do it as quickly as I can.
Super.
I think you really have to start, but I'll be terse about everything because it's a long list. You really have to start with the housing bubble, because if it wasn't for the craziness in housing, I think a lot of this never would have happened. Most of it never would have happened, even though there were some fragilities already built into the system. So you had the craziness in housing interacting painfully with disgraceful underwriting standards, almost equally disgraceful risk management systems at many banks and investment banks and others, a web of complicated derivatives that both magnified leverage, which is perhaps the biggest underlying cause of the whole shebang, and created, whether intentionally or unintentionally, and I suspect it was a mixture, a great deal of opacity. The consequence of that was when things started going wrong after 2006, it's not obvious exactly where you date this, but something in that time frame, a lot of people and institutions got worried about the balance sheets of their counterparties and really didn't understand what exposures they had. And by the way, a lot of the institutions didn't know their own exposures very well. So that's a kind of a recipe for panic when you're worried about your counterparties and you feel there's a lack of transparency and so on. And so we had these waves of intermittent panic and quasi-relaxation up until Lehman Brothers. And I've obviously left out a lot of details like Bear Stearns and so on. And then after Lehman Brothers, it was just total panic. I think I attribute that total panic, although there are always multiple causes, to the perception in the financial markets that the rules of the game had been abruptly changed, that there were certain tacit rules of the game that had been established in the Bear Stearns case and the aftermath thereof, and all of that got thrown away as Lehman went down the tubes. And that exposed in a grand way all of these weaknesses that had been there before. The very thick web of opaque interconnections among financial institutions, the extreme leverage that these institutions had been living with, the extreme illiquidity that they had been living with. And it was quickly and rapidly downhill from there. That's a really short answer to a question that would probably take 1,000 pages to fully answer.
Well, actually, we're hoping that it only takes about 500 pages.
That's what you have, huh?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there may be some specific aspect you want to go into in more detail. I'm happy to do that.
Well, one thing that I'd love to ask you about, given your experience, oh, I hear an echo. Given your experience, you know, as a policymaker, I don't know, slash regulator, I guess. What changes, or were there changes in the financial system that you saw from those positions that are noteworthy that we should be paying attention to as we think about the causes of the crisis?
Do you mean that I saw all the way back when I was at the Fed, or that I see recently?
Well, actually, even all the way back when you were at the Fed.
So I think not that much was happening then. That was just the beginning. I can remember very well. That was just the beginning of things that later blossomed as credit default swaps. And I can remember very well getting briefings from the Fed staff on these mysterious and strange instruments that weren't this and weren't that and didn't seem to fit into any regulatory box very well, and what we're supposed to think about them or do about them. But they were very small in volume at that point, certainly not posing any kinds of systemic risk. So I think the problems that we faced in the crisis, the roots of those problems don't quite go back, except in trivial ways, to the 90s, but really go back to the zeros, or whatever you call that decade, from 2000 to 2009. Including the bubbles, including the blow-up in leverage, including the explosion of derivatives, and including the subprime mortgages. Now, subprime mortgages existed back then, but they were a much smaller share of the mortgage market, and they weren't such crazy mortgages. You didn't have these, I mean, I'm sure there were examples, but you didn't have volumes of non-amortizing or sometimes negative amortizing mortgages. You didn't have so many of these crazy ARMs. You didn't have the payment in kind, and I'm sure I'm leaving out six other wild and woolly variants that came in, you know, much more in the years 2004, 5, 6 than a decade earlier than that. And I guess implicit in what I was just saying, but let me make it explicit. The relative weight of the banking system to the shadow banking system was much higher in the mid-90s than it was a decade later.
But it was changing.
By the mid-2000s, the shadow banking system was starting to dwarf the formal banking system. And as you all know, that shadow banking system just wasn't regulated.
But the trends of the shifting importance of these two systems, you don't date those trends back to the 90s?
I mean, yes, it started back then, but it just wasn't. What's the right way to put this? The proportions were just dramatically different. Yeah, the trend does go back to the 1990s, but the question, I guess one way to put it is, which is the tail and which is the dog? And it was very, very clear back then when I was on the Fed that the shadow banking system was the tail, not the dog. By a decade later, one could argue it had been reversed.
Right. But so back when you were at the Fed, the growth of the shadow banking system was not on the radar screen?
It was, but mainly in the following sense. We were concerned as bank regulators with the eroding competitive position of banks, which of course would threaten ultimately their safety and soundness, due to the competition they were getting from a variety of non-banks. And these were mainly Wall Street firms that were taking deposits from them and getting into the loan business to some extent. So, yeah, it was a concern. You could see a downward trend in the share of banking assets to financial assets. And I remember looking at such graphs a number of times in Fed staff briefings. But I think the magnitude, or the perceived magnitude, maybe we were deluding ourselves, but the perceived magnitude of the problem was not that great in the mid-90s.
All right, and then now, that's very helpful. Now, rolling us up to the present, I assume you... Oh, and I guess, wait, I'm sorry, before we leave the 90s, one of the things that you've also talked about is the role of compensation. But were there changes over time in compensation that we should be paying attention to?
Well, there were certainly changes in the level of compensation, clearly. It escalated tremendously. I'm not sure exactly how to date it, but between 1995 and 2005, it changed immensely as to magnitude. As to nature, I'm not sure. I don't think we have a good database on this, but back, I remember back, and I've written about this, back in the 90s, wondering why financial institutions, and by the way, then I was thinking more about hedge funds than about banks, maybe I should have been thinking more about banks, were compensating their traders the way they were, giving these traders very strong financial incentives to go for broke, which seemed to me a crazy thing to do. I wasn't thinking so much then about regulating that practice as wondering why in the world were the firms allowing such perverse incentives to exist when it seemed palatably to be against their self-interest. I'm sounding a little like Alan Greenspan here.
No. No.
I was shocked that they were managing their businesses so badly. And I talked to some of them about this, and the answer I got back was that fearful answer that you never want to hear, which is everybody else is doing.
Right.
You know, one of the maxims of my life is when someone answers a question, everyone else is doing it, you should head for the hills, because that's not a good reason. So I'm not sure that the compensation, other than magnitude, I'm not sure that the structural nature of the compensation systems of traders changed that much from, say, 95 to 2005. I mean, if it did, it's not something I'm aware of.
One of the things that we're seeing, that we're researching, is the shift, I mean, just thinking about traders, is the shift from... you know, fixed commissions to, a compensation structure that just creates a very different set of incentives
I'm not talking about fixed commissions. I'm talking about traders getting paid a share of the profits.
Right.
And not getting a share of the losses.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
No, that's right. I mean, so there are changes in compensation structures that we are trying to document.
Very useful, because I don't think they're well documented at all.
Yep. And do levels matter?
It's a really good question. I think levels matter, yes, in the sense that if you give perverse incentives and the reward could be $100,000 on the upside, versus you give perverse incentives and the reward could be $10 million on the upside, I think you've created a much stronger perverse incentive. You see what I mean?
I do. I mean, I guess the insofar as the distribution is, not symmetric, not symmetrical, then yes, levels matter.
Right. You had a non-symmetrical system before and after, but as the amount of money that's at stake blows up by a factor of 10 or 100, that incentive to, I'm going to say misbehave, but that's not quite the right verb, because these traders were actually doing what they should do given the crazy incentives that were given to them by their superiors. But to misbehave from a social perspective,
right,
also blows up by a factor of 10 or 100.
So now the million-dollar question is, why didn't we see that this was happening? And I guess for this, I mean, you know, the various factors that you pointed to as causing the crisis. Where were the gatekeepers? Where were the, you know, the people who were supposed to be watching over the system?
So you mean all? You're not now just talking about compensation,
right? I mean your list, your list of what caused the crisis.
So let's see. Let's start with compensation and go to some of the others. As I said before, I don't think most bank regulators thought regulating compensation was really part of their business, and I just think that issue got very little attention in the 90s and into the 2000s. I mean, it had been bothering me from the 90s, and I had raised it many, many times. But, you know, who was I? I was just one person. By early 96, I'm not even in the government anymore, so I certainly don't have any influence over anything. So there were a few people worrying out loud about that, but not that many. So I think for the most part, that was off the radar screen. The leverage issue, I think, was partly hidden. I think a lot of people were shocked to find out the kind of leverage that the big five brokerage or investment bank firms were operating with. And I know a lot of people were shocked, including the bankers inside the banks, with how much real leverage they had acquired via sieves and conduits and things like that off the balance sheet. This is part of the dreadful risk management that I alluded to before. The derivatives volume just escalated. Well, two things. The subprime mortgages and the derivatives volume just escalated so rapidly that if you weren't really paying attention to this on a daily or weekly basis, you always had an obsolete view of their seriousness. I was one of such people. I mean, I'm a professor. I'm not watching these things on a daily basis. And when the subprime mortgage debacle broke, I said to myself, and I probably said out loud, I could check that on Google, I guess, that this is just a small corner of the mortgage market. And Ben Bernanke said that at the Fed. Well, it turned out not to be such a small corner. It was a minority, of course, but by no means such a small corner because it had grown very, very rapidly. You could make a similar statement about the CDS market, which grew like Topsy, and unless you were really in there watching, you probably had no idea what the volumes were. And they, in turn, not the CDS, the CDO, et cetera, created an embedded leverage that was extreme. And to the extent that the size of these transactions was not understood by most people, and that they were opaque, so the actual nature of some of these securities was not very well understood, the system got much, much more leverage than I think anybody realized. And I'm going to say anybody. There's always somebody, but most people realize. I'll give you a little example of that, a trivial example of that. The structure of these CDOs, I'm sure you know more about it than I do, I've been digging deeply into it now, had these mezzanine tranches, some of which were so, so thin that a minor change in the value of the underlying securities would change the value of some of these mezzanine tranches from 100 to zero, or almost to zero, really, really quickly. That's tantamount to having titanic leverage. It's not literal leverage, but it's synthetic leverage. And I'm pretty sure that most of the people that own these mezzanine tranches had no idea about that.
So how should we think about then defining leverage? Because it sounds like there's a lot of different ways to define it.
Yeah, I think for risk management purposes, leverage, which is going to be assets to capital, is a step. You need that. But it needs to be supplemented very heavily by a recognition of exposures and the sensitivity of exposures to underlying events. So you can have leverage literally buy a security with 10% down and 90% bar, and you can, your returns, therefore, are a multiple of 10 of the underlying returns. But you can also buy a derivative for cash. In fact, a lot of these original derivative transactions, as you know, when they start, they're net neutral on cash. Each counterparty is even. And the cash only comes in as the price of the underlying move. So in a literal sense of the word leverage, they're not even leverage transactions, but the sensitivity of the institution or individual's exposure to the movement in the underlying security is extreme.
Yep.
In some cases. So I guess I'm giving you a long-winded answer that comes down to leverage is just not enough.
Yep. No, I've tried to argue with people around here that CDS contracts, you know, where you know, Paulson can put a teeny bit down and get a huge possible payout, you know, that we should be thinking of those, or even better, that, you know, you can possibly get these small income streams, but may have to make huge payouts, that we should somehow be thinking of those as leverage.
Yeah, I mean, that we need to think of that as leverage.
Yep.
It's not the literal meaning of leverage.
Yeah, it upsets the people who around here who, you know, think as Wall Street analysts. So one thing
I think that's really, really important.
Yeah.
So hang on to that thought.
Yeah. I'm an economist.
Don't let them talk you out of it.
I'm an economist among, you know, analysts and lawyers, so.
Right.
And you haven't mentioned global capital flows and monetary policy.
Well, I would put a quite small weight on global capital flows. The respects in which it gets some weight, not zero, are two mainly. One is the ability of Wall Street to merchandise some of this crap outside the United States, right? To pension funds in Italy, municipal governments in Norway, and so on, that had no clue about what they were buying. So that helped in the dissemination of the garbage. But I think they could have sold it all in America if they, or most of it in America if they had to. So that's a minor contributor. The other, slipping on, I had a second thing that I wanted to, the other obviously is that the global capital markets and the so-called savings glut, which is not a U.S. savings glut, but was more of an Asian savings glut, put the whole level of interest rates down around the world, including in the United States, and of course lower interest rates inflate asset prices. Now you could call that fundamentals, it depends how fundamental the savings glut is. And that of course brings me to the Fed. I'm of the school that says the Fed in retrospect did keep interest rates too low for too long in the period, in the 2003-04 period before they started raising in mid-2004. And that did contribute somewhat to the bubble, but this is really a minor cause of the bubble.
And the mechanism?
If I fault the Fed, which I do, it's much more for their on their supervisory role than on their monetary policy role.
And on the monetary policy, what's the mechanism?
The mechanism there is basically the same mechanism I was talking about with the savings glut, that you have the Fed holding down short-term interest rates, holding down interest rates, which first of all, A, holds down the level of interest rates in general, and B, encourages this carry trade, that you go to the money market. You know, you're a we know what Lehman Brothers and Goldman Sachs and all those were doing. They were going to the money market, borrowing at really, really low rates, and, quote, lending in various forms at much higher rates. And the Fed, cheap money, enabled was one of the enablers of that process. So there was some contribution.
And so I'm sure.
But I don't think it was nearly as. I mean, you've probably either talked to or read the work of John Taylor, who puts like the lion's share of the blame for the bubble on those low Federal Reserve interest rates. I think that's a great exaggeration.
And we've also talked to Vince Reinhardt, who talks about the steep yield curve and the problems of gradualism, of only slowly raising the short end of the yield curve, which sounds a little bit like where you are.
So what I said before is with the wisdom of hindsight, the Fed kept them too low for too long, but they had a reason for doing that. The economy seemed stuck in the mud. Jobs were not being created. And then in the middle of 2004, they did start raising interest rates. So it's not like they held them that long right through the bubble.
Right.
And part of the evidence for saying, well, there are several pieces of evidence suggesting that the higher interest rates that John Taylor and others would have liked to have seen earlier would have done only a little good, not that much good. One is that the Fed did start raising interest rates in the middle of 94 and continued, and the bubble just got worse and worse and worse. Another is that England had a similar bubble with much, much higher interest rates. And the third is just the pure common sense, which is if prospective homeowners are expecting 15 to 20% annualized capital gains, and surveys show that they were, then whether their mortgage interest rate is going to be 6% or 6.5% is not going to be a first-order factor in decisions to buy, not to mention decisions to buy and flip. So it's in there. I mean, it does matter. With higher interest rates, you'd have these activities would have been less attractive. But the question is how high? I mean, let me be spiritually accurate and put some numbers on this. Suppose the short rate should have been 200 basis points higher than it was. Then maybe the mortgage rate would have been 80 basis points higher than it was. And does anybody really think that an 80 basis point mortgage rate would have made a world of difference to this phenomenon? I mean, I don't. It would have made some marginal. There are always people at the margin that would have been deterred, but I don't think it would have made a fundamental difference. And then you turn it around. Okay, so what should the Fed have done? Raise the short rate to 10%, 12%? I mean, I don't think anybody believes that would have been sound monetary policy.
And, I had a very good question. You mentioned international. And what was happening in Great Britain? Are there lessons that we should be drawing? How can we learn about the causes of our financial crisis by looking abroad?
Well, I think you can in a whole variety of ways. So maybe the most obvious is that as you look abroad, and by the way, I don't purport to be the biggest expert on this. But as you look abroad, you find a very wide variety of methods of mortgage finance. That is the GSE, Fannie Freddie, 30-year fixed non-recourse mortgage with interest tax deductible. And I've left out some things about that in characterizing the U.S. system. Is not the norm around the world. I'm not sure there is a norm around the world. There are lots of different systems. The Canadian system, as you no doubt know, showed terrific stability in the bubble and the aftermath in an economy that looks, at least superficially, well, I don't think just superficially, looks and is very much like ours. but had a quite different regulatory structure and this different system of mortgage finance and a different tax system. In Denmark and a few other places, you have these covered bonds, which seem to be a much a stabler way to do this financing. So I don't know. I don't have a fixed idea in my head right now saying this is the country we should emulate and we should do it like they do. But I do think there are a number of promising examples out there, of which Canada and Denmark come to mind immediately.
All right, I have a whole different set of questions, which is policy reactions to the crisis. So it's not our job to figure out whether or not policy reactions to the crisis were optimal, but it certainly is our job to figure out if policy reactions to the crisis helped to cause the crisis,
right.
If they were in some way causal. Are there ones that we should be looking at?
Well,
except for, you mentioned Lehman. Right, sorry, you mentioned Lehman. Others?
I mean, that's almost too obvious to
yes.
to mention. So, obviously, Lehman was, well, to me it's obvious, not obvious to everybody, that Lehman was a colossal mistake. And as you know, the Dodd-Frank Act, there are provisions that are meant to ensure that we never have another Lehman. Hopefully that'll work when push comes to shove, and it was certainly the right thing to do. As I'm sure you know, and as the commission has heard under oath, I'm sure, the key government players at the time, Secretary Paulson, Chairman Bernanke, and Tim Geithner, who was then head of the New York Fed, argued at the time and since that their hands were tied, that there was nothing that they could have done. I think in some sense that is one of the most crucial questions. To what extent was that true? To what extent was it not true? We know a couple of things. We know that at minimum, these folks and others would have had to stretch the law to its breaking point, or let's say toward its breaking point, to do what was needed to save Lehman. So it was going to be a stretch. We know that the FSA threw a monkey wrench into the process at a very late date, at which point it was hard to retrieve the situation. We also know, however, that once the crisis really blew up after Lehman, the Treasury and the Fed started doing totally unprecedented things, and the FDIC too, by the way, totally unprecedented things whose legality probably could have been challenged. But as I've often put it in conversation with people, who was going to sue them for doing these things? The answer was nobody. So I think sorting out that episode is crucial to the broader question because that episode was so crucial. Now, not everybody believes this. I've been in debates with people, you probably have also, that say Lehman sort of just looked important, but it really wasn't that important. If it wasn't Lehman, it would have been something else. I'm dubious about that. But, of course, nobody will ever know the answer to that. So there's that whole set of issues. There are a whole set of issues surrounding the way the TARP was used, which was quite different from its stated purpose while it was going through the congressional process. I don't have to go into details about that, you know what I mean. It is a troubled assets relief program, and in the end had almost nothing to do with troubled assets, and in the Bush administration was essentially not used at all to mitigate the foreclosure problem, which was the slow-motion train wreck that everybody saw coming. And then in the Obama administration, it was used much more than in the Bush administration, but still, in my view, not enough. Not strongly enough. And then there are tons of details that, you know, neither one of us have all day. You folks have been delving into many, many aspects of this. Maybe if there's some particular ones other than what I just mentioned you want to ask about.
Well, I guess, you know, again, trying to maybe create an arbitrary distinction between policy that could have been better and policy that actually caused the crisis. Do you think that had TARP been used differently, if that money hadn't been used to recapitalize banks and instead had been used to buy troubled assets, would the crisis from that point forward have looked very different?
Not very different. I think a little different. Okay. But people have the opposite view of me, so this is not a uniform position. Here's what I thought, basically. And I still think this is right, but as I said, other people think it's wrong. The argument was made at the time that the TARP was changed into a recapitalization of banks that you needed to put this capital into banks because they would leverage it 10 to 1 and you'd get $10 of lending for every dollar of capital. Well, I think what we got was about $0 of lending for every dollar of capital. And that, I think, was one of the mistakes of the TARP. Now we're into details. I thought at the time, and I certainly still do, that banks that were offered this extraordinary assistance, often life-saving assistance by the government, should have been forced to comply with certain public purpose provisions, of which the two most obvious to me were, the three most, limitations on executive pay, which they did have, limitations on dividend payouts to their shareholders, which they didn't have, and some minimal lending requirements, which they didn't have. That should have been the quid pro quo, or part of the quid pro quo, for the publicly provided, let's remember, capital. If they were not raising this from the capital markets, they were getting it from the taxpayer. And I thought that was a mistake. Now, if you're going to take that attitude, which was the attitude that I took at the time and still have, you don't want to force this capital on banks that don't want it, which I think was another tactical mistake made in the Paulson Treasury. You remember that fateful day in October, I think, of 2008 when Secretary Paulson called the nine biggest bankers into his office and shoved capital down their throats, including several who walked out the door and basically told the press, we don't need it, we don't want it. If you're going to attach a lot of strings, now, Paulson did not at that point attach any strings. If you're going to attach a lot of strings to the capital, as I was just suggesting, you should then make it voluntary whether the banks take it. It's just not right. It's not fair to the businesses to say, all right, I'm going to force you to take this capital, and because of that, I'm going to put all these strings on it. I'm going to attach all these strings to it. That's not fair play or good business or good government or anything. But I think it is fair play and good public policy to let the banks decide, let the banks that need it come forward and claim it, and then to attach public policy strings to it, which we didn't do. Now, we began to a little bit under the Obama administration. Or maybe I'm not quite getting the timing. Maybe even at the end of Bush, I can't remember. I associated with the Obama administration with the executive pay.
I think that that's
so right. That's half of your answer, that I wasn't as enamored of the capital injections as many other people were, although I recognize the need for more capital, so don't get me wrong. I don't think that was wrong-headed at all in that sense. Second thing is the reasons I liked buying the toxic assets. Let's go back one step. The biggest objection to buying the toxic assets was pricing them. And a lot of people said the government's just going to price them too high, and that's a way to shovel money into banks. My view was that nobody really knew the exact right prices for these assets, but there were mechanisms that might have been used for price discovery. And besides that, given the magnitude of the problem, if we were off 10 or 15%, either way, that was not going to be a calamity. So recognize that you could either go too high or too low by a margin like that. And then, by the way, have the ability to adjust the prices. As you saw, you're either too high or too low by the take-up. So there was a problem of pricing, which you never could have gotten right. But my view is this, that underlying all of this was, and maybe I was wrong, but this is my view, was an irrationally low pricing of these toxic assets because of the panic. And if you could ease that a bit, then banks would have better-looking balance sheets. There'd be some hope to maintain a mortgage securitization market. And this cascading of one weak counterparty weakening another weak counterparty, etc., could be, if not ended, at least mitigated by making it known that there was some value to these assets. The problem was, when nobody knew what these things were worth, the tendency was to assume the worst. And I thought the assume the worst was an excessively pessimistic assumption. By the way, you may remember that a great many of these, quote, toxic assets were current at the time. The assets had fallen dramatically in value because when the euphoria broke, people started assuming the worst about the underlying mortgage pools. Even though they were still paying, in most cases, the assumption was many of them would go into default. And I thought we could have nicked that process in the bud, at least a little bit, by buying up some of these toxic assets. You know, getting to the bedrock cause of the financial panic. Anyway, that was my opinion and the opinion of some others, and the argument that was used to sell this to Congress, but in the end it wasn't used for that purpose.
So we actually have a dual mandate of figuring out what the causes of both the financial and the economic crisis are. If the banks had been, if those who took TARP money had been required to commit to some certain amount of lending, would that have, would we be in less of an economic crisis than we're in right now?
I think so. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think we would have averted a recession. When you have that much wealth destruction, that much weakening of the financial system in a world in which there's so much excessive leverage going in, you're going to have a recession, and you're probably going to have a serious recession. But, you know, there are recessions and there are recessions. There are 2% of GDP recessions and 3% of GDP recessions and 4% of GDP recessions. We just got a 4% of GDP recession. I think we could have had a smaller one.
And I know, as you know, drawing connections between a financial crisis and an economic crisis, you know, the wealth effect is an obvious connection. That's kind of a gimme. The other effects are actually a little harder for us to, I don't want to say prove.
After the wealth effect, I would look at the credit spreads, which blew up. So think about what that means, right? We look at riskless interest rates like the Fed funds rate and the Treasury, the various Treasury borrowing rates. But almost nobody is doing an economic transaction at those rates. The rates at which actual economic transactions take place are all risky rates, corporate lending rates, corporate bond rates, mortgage rates, auto loan rates, et cetera. And the spreads on all of those things blew up tremendously because of the travails in the financial system. So that's a second link after the wealth effect.
Well, wait.
And then the third link, yeah. These are all related, of course. The third link is the contraction of credit. I mean, if you look at bank credit, it contracted very dramatically, and it's still contracting. If you look at securitized credits, shadow banking credit, it practically disappeared.
But, again, I know you know this, but, of course, what the challenge that we're facing is, you know, what's endogenous. And maybe credit spreads are blowing out because people are simply, because of the economic crisis, which is happening on its own, people are just worse risks. And it's not that the financial crisis has caused that. It's just simply that those spreads are reflecting reality. And in terms of credit crunch, maybe there's no credit crunch, and maybe just nobody wants to borrow because there's a bad economy.
Right. In my view, I mean, that's a good point. In my view, the way to think about this is the following. During the period of euphoria, the credit spreads shrunk to unsustainably and in some cases ridiculously low levels. A return to normalcy would have had as one of its concomitants an increase in credit spreads across the board. But what happened after, mainly this happened after Lehman, it started somewhat as happening before Lehman, but mainly after Lehman, was credit spreads just blowing out to incredible heights. Endogenous for sure, but way overshooting, as markets almost always do, their fundamental values. And you can see that in the behavior of spreads. You take a time series plot of any spread you want, basically, and I'm sure you've looked at these, and you see that in the years 2003, 4, 5, 6, something like that, it's different market to market, the timing, they're shrinking to well below historic norms. Then they go up irregularly with events to dizzying heights after Lehman. And then as the remedies start getting applied, they start falling again. And by now, I think most of them are back down to something approaching historic norms. So it looks like there was a bubble in fixed income, and that bubble burst, and as often happens in markets, the markets went kaplooey, way overshot the non-bubble equilibrium, and only gradually got back to the non-bubble equilibrium.
And is it having an effect now? Or, I mean, now, you know, so you look at spreads in financial markets, and as you say, a lot of them are back to normal.
Yes.
Is there any current link between the financial crisis and the economic crisis? Aside from the wealth effect.
Yes. There is, in a couple of respects, some of which are understandable and some of which I find very puzzling. So the most obvious one is securitization, which was a major form of lending before the crisis and is a legitimate form of lending, I think, by the way, practically evaporated. And it's not come back, other than the Fannie Freddie stuff that is subsidized by the taxpayer. So that's one aspect that does not come back. Second is something I still find mysterious, is the banks are still sitting on that $1 trillion of excess reserves that they got shortly after Lehman went under. I understood in the early period why there was this hoarding of liquidity. I'm puzzled now in September 2010, 2 years later, that they're still hoarding this much liquidity.
You don't think it's that it's that fabulous return that they're getting from the Fed?
No, I don't. I'd like the Fed to lower it, but I don't think it's that fabulous return they're getting from the Fed. I mean, it must be some combination of fear of a lingering need to repair their balance sheets, although most big bank balance sheets look pretty good right now. And I don't know what else. I mean, I confess, I'm puzzled. I would have thought that that volume of excess reserves would have come down as the economy pulled out of the worst. But it hasn't. And I suspect that in ways not fully understood, or certainly not fully understood by me, a lot of that is the legacy of the financial crisis.
Do you think that people are, I'm taking us a little off topic now, so I don't want to keep you too long, so mostly you should just tell me if there's anything else you want to tell me, but does the part of that uncertainty, does it have to do with the Federal Reserve's balance sheet or the size of the deficit?
The Federal Reserve balance sheet?
Yeah, I mean,
is that what you asked? I just didn't hear you.
Oh, yeah. So do you think markets and banks are just are freaked out about what's to come over the next couple of years because of the policy responses, because of the Fed's balance sheet and the deficit, et cetera?
No. there may be a little of that. If you're freaked out, let's take them in pieces. If you're freaked out about the Fed's balance sheet, that means you're probably worried about inflation.
Yes.
I don't think too many of them are worried about inflation, frankly. And to the extent that you can read inflation worries in markets by pricing, like in tips and places like that, it's clear that the pricing is not reflecting in inflation fears. To the extent that that markets are freaked out about the federal budget picture, a couple of things to say about that. That should mean higher interest rates in the not too distant future, and that should be telling people that if you're holding a lot of long-term bonds with 2.5% interest rates, you better watch out because there may be some big capital losses there, which should lead to selling pressure, which we're not seeing. It might also be leading to weakness in the dollar, which we're not really seeing to any significant extent. So it doesn't look to me that the markets are terribly fearful about the consequences of either the Fed's balance sheet or the budget deficit.
The only thing that I wanted to say on that is some of the fears that I think people may have on the Fed balance sheet is that the Fed may feel pressure to actually put assets into the market too quickly, and that can have
right.
But
that's right. But that should have been alleviated by the last Fed meeting, and the Fed decided to stop shrinking its balance sheet.
Right. Right. Is there anything else that you want to make sure we know as we're writing our report?
Let me think. I guess, yes, there's one other. I sort of touched on this very lightly, but I want to touch it more heavily. I touched on it lightly in talking about the opacity of some of the fancy financial instruments. The opacity is highly connected to the complexity. While I said a few moments ago that I still think that securitization has a legitimate place in the financial system, I think it's mainly plain vanilla securitization, and it would take a lot to convince me that CDO squared ever had any social utility, as opposed to just being ways for Wall Street to extract more wealth from the rest of the world. So I think both regulators and people in the industry should be taking a fresh and somewhat jaundiced look at the complexity of some of the instruments that were created. And I mention this because I'm pretty much convinced that when the dust settles, and it's not quite settled yet, as you were suggesting, they'll go back to those bad old ways.
I mean, one of the things we've heard, sort of going back to your time at the Fed, one of the things that we've heard is that regulators or policymakers just weren't in a position to understand what was going on because of the complexity.
I think that's right, but it's at least equally important, probably more important, that the investors didn't understand what was going on, and even that the issuing firms didn't understand what was going on. I mean, on the latter, how else can you explain how much of the pot they got stuck with when the game ended? Right? Smart guys, like Goldman Sachs Goldman got out of most of it. They were the smartest of the smart. But the other smart guys, like Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, etc., and even Morgan Stanley, got stuck holding an awful lot of the stuff in the end.
So I think that maybe leads me to my last question, which is, you know, these are smart investors who are supposed to understand adverse selection, and they're supposed to price for it.
Yep.
Why didn't they?
Well, they weren't so smart. They A, weren't so smart, and B, this comes back to the complexity, that they didn't understand. Look, you know that many, many investors, this is going to bring up a subject we haven't touched yet, many, many investors looked at some of these instruments, hadn't the foggiest clue what the hell they were about, but saw a AAA label and said, okay, let's buy them.
But you go to buy a used car, and it's a complicated engine, and it's a complicated car, you know, and so you price for the fact that there's a lot of things that are unknown. Why didn't they do that with these complicated instruments? I can't understand
question.
I'm going to price for that.
It's a really good question. I think it's part of what happens in a bubbly, euphoric attitude. We don't usually get bubbles in used cars for whatever reason, but we do get bubbles in financial markets and tulip bulbs and tech stocks and other things. You know, people sort of lose their heads. This is the madness of crowds, and it happens now and then. And I don't think we can stop that, by the way. But I think we can mitigate it somewhat with a sturdier financial system.
An excellent note to end on. This has been incredibly helpful on my end. So. Thank you very much for taking the time as we figure out, you know, how to come into the home stretch and write a report. These sorts of interviews are just enormously helpful, so thank you.
Well, you're very, very welcome. I'm glad to help, because I think one of the things this country really, really needs is, and still doesn't have, is a narrative of what happened and why. What you're seeing in the country now, I think, is inchoate anger. They're just mad. They don't really know what they're mad at or who they're mad at, except bankers and apparently incumbent politicians. But it's an inchoate anger because the story is just not well understood. So to the extent you can tell the story well and in an intelligible way, it will be a great service.
We're trying. All right. Thanks. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Stop.